If you're adding up the dollars you're spending this holiday, you may also want to consider a different kind of cost, the cost in pollution of getting that holiday dinner to your home. On this Thanksgiving, our last word in business is carbon wing print. Your turkey, of course, did not fly to your table, but it likely did travel by truck to get to the grocer. And that trip probably started in a state like Minnesota or North Carolina, which are leading turkey producers. So if you're a long way away from Minnesota or North Carolina, there's a big carbon footprint. Your cranberries are most likely from Wisconsin or Massachusetts, which together produce more than 80% of them in the United States. Now, the Natural Resources Defense Council, which monitors things like this, says it doesn't have to be this way. Many ingredients for Thanksgiving dinner can be found at local farmers markets. Even turkeys can be found locally on websites like localharvest.org. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
There is stunning news today from the world of turtle paleontology. Scientists are reporting they found a turtle on the half shell, literally. It's a 220-million-year-old fossil found in China of a turtle that had a shell underneath its belly but no shell on its back. As NPR's Joe Palca reports, this new discovery should help scientists answer a question that's puzzled both them and kids. Just how did the turtle get its shell?
It's hard to overstate just how exciting the Chinese find is.
It is probably the most important discovery concerning turtles for the past 40 or 50 years.
Paleontologist Eugene Gaffney has spent his 40-year research career studying turtles. He's recently retired from the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Until the Chinese fossil came along, he had introduced the world to the oldest turtle, a fossil found in Germany. That turtle looked like a turtle, with a hard shell covering its back.
But this specimen has sort of a halfway intermediate formed turtle shell.
In fact, the new find is known as Odontochelys semitestacea.
Semitestacea means half shells.
Olivier Riepel is with the Field Museum in Chicago. He's a co-author on the paper in the journal Nature describing the Chinese finding. He says the new fossil represents a kind of primitive turtle, one that hasn't quite figured out how to make the hard shell on top and bottom that modern turtles have. By studying this kind of intermediate step, scientists should learn more about how the turtle shell evolved. Now, Riepel says a hard shell is critical for a turtle planning to make a living on dry land.
An animal like a turtle living on land will not be attacked from below. It will be attacked from above.
But Riepel says a turtle living in the water can get by without a shell on top because swimming animals will typically be attacked from below. That's why Riepel and his colleagues in China believe this turtle has a marine origin. Riepel says another factor arguing in favor of a watery lifestyle is that the part of southwestern China where the fossil was found was a marine basin 230 million years ago. In addition to the half shell, the Chinese turtle has another remarkable feature.
This turtle has teeth, which modern turtles don't have, so that's a very primitive character of this fossil turtle.
Modern turtles have a hard beak made of keratin instead of teeth. Now, it may seem odd that an animal that had managed to evolve something as clever as teeth would then unevolve them, but paleontologist Robert Rice says it isn't. Rice is at the University of Toronto, Mississauga.
Remember, birds do that too. Their ancestors had teeth, and birds eliminated their dentition and developed a similar structure to that of turtles, that they have that beak that they use very efficiently.
And that's the great thing about paleontology, specialization. Someone has actually taken the time to compare the beaks of birds with the beaks of turtles. American Museum of Natural History's Gene Gaffney says you can get even more specialized than that.
There have been a number of people that have devoted their careers to studying turtle ears and their physiology and functions and so forth.
The career opportunities abound. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. President-elect Obama has promised measures to deal with climate change, such as slashing greenhouse gases. Keeping that pledge would be challenging even in good financial times. In our latest memo to the president, NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports on the obstacles to changing environmental policy.
No one seems to doubt the president-elect's commitment to tackling climate change. But lots of environmental activists, scientists, and business leaders worry that a recession and two wars will put global warming on the back burner.
There will be so many reasons not to attend to climate change.
William Riley headed the Environmental Protection Agency under the first President Bush. He says delaying would be risky, both for the planet and for Mr. Obama.
It would be a matter of huge disappointment if a new president did not give this the priority he has promised to give it. And even more, it would affect his standing in world opinion. The United States is quite properly seen to have dragged its feet on the most important environmental issue of the day.
The president-elect favors an approach modeled after the program that has cut acid rain pollution 50% since 1990. It's called cap and trade. The government would set a cap on how much global warming pollution businesses can emit and then tighten that cap over time. The government also would create a new market. Instead of stocks, businesses would trade the right to pollute. Riley helped create the acid rain program. He says it will be much trickier to craft a market for controlling the most abundant greenhouse gas.
Carbon dioxide is a much more difficult pollutant to control. It's combustion. It's a basis for civilized life.
That means instead of just power plants, the bill would regulate the whole economy. Last summer, the Senate tried and failed to pass a bipartisan version of this approach. And that was before the credit crisis hit. The financial collapse makes members of Congress much more skittish about passing on big costs to businesses.
Right now, we're in a recession. Right now, people are very nervous. And the last thing we need to do is add on a whole new layer of costs to factories.
Drew Greenblatt owns Marlin Steel Wire in Baltimore. His 27 employees and several robots are busy fulfilling orders from around the world for wire baskets. Greenblatt says he's an environmentalist. He uses only recycled steel, but he's dead set against Mr. Obama's climate policy.
Our energy costs will go up. A lot of our clients will have challenges because their energy costs will go up.
Greenblatt says workers would suffer, companies would cut back on health care, and maybe have layoffs. Economists predict that businesses would pass most of the costs on to customers.
We're looking at the creation of a program that has a value of hundreds of billions of dollars every year, and it's going to deeply affect households.
Dallas Bertrau is an economist at the Washington, D.C. think tank, Resources for the Future.
Families can expect to pay more for electricity, more for gasoline at the pump, more for natural gas or oil to heat their homes.
Bertrau says the government could help offset this pain by offering a big rebate. Still, he thinks the recent financial market fiascos could make it difficult to gain public support for a massive new market that will trade something as ephemeral as greenhouse gases. Supporters of the market approach say they're concerned about this.
What if we've lost faith in markets? What do we do?
Jim Rogers is CEO of Duke Energy, a big electric company in the Carolinas. He says other options, such as taxing businesses or directly regulating greenhouse gases, just wouldn't work. He says a market would help businesses cut carbon dioxide, or CO2, in the cheapest possible way, just as they do in the acid rain program.
There's nothing in that experience that tells me that won't work for CO2.
Rogers predicts that once companies have to pay to pollute, they'll find cleaner ways to do business.
Let's create the most energy-efficient economy in the world, and it would create jobs and stimulate our economy. That would be the smartest thing to do, because we're not talking about rescue plan or bailout. We're talking about reinvesting in the future, in a future that's going to be a low-carbon world.
In fact, if the government auctions off the right to pollute instead of giving it away, it could raise $100 billion a year, maybe more. That money could help companies build wind farms, design electric cars, and come up with cleaner ways to burn coal. Or it could be divvied up to households. That could help take away the sting of the new climate policy and the recession. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
Here's one more way that human life is changing the oceans. It involves the carbon dioxide that we emit, the same substance that contributes to climate change. That carbon dioxide is also making the oceans more acidic. A new study finds the process is happening at a breathtaking rate at one study area off the coast of Washington State. Acid in the ocean is reshaping ocean life. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
About half the carbon dioxide we emit into the atmosphere gets soaked up in the oceans. That's good news for us. The air isn't heating up as fast as it otherwise would. But Tim Wooten at the University of Chicago says that's bad news for the oceans.
As carbon dioxide increases in the atmosphere, it dissolves into water as well. And when it does that, it reacts with water and creates carbonic acid.
That carbonic acid is already making ocean waters slightly more corrosive around the world. But rarely has anyone really taken the time to see whether that acid is changing ocean ecosystems. Wooten just happened to include acid measurements in a long-term study he's doing on Tatoosh Island, which is half a mile off the coast of Washington State. As expected, Wooten saw a trend toward greater acidity over the past 8 years.
What surprised us, though, is the rate at which this was occurring. It's been occurring a lot faster, about 10 times faster than had been predicted from physical models of the ocean and the atmosphere and how they interact.
Wooten doesn't know why the waters at Tatoosh Island are changing so much faster than expected. Whatever the cause, it's creating rapid changes in the ecosystem as well. Wooten says 10 to 20% of the mussels along the coast disappeared in just that 8-year period to be replaced by algae and other less acid-sensitive species.
When we project where these shifts are going in the long run, they're actually pretty alarming. The demise of mussels as a dominant species is potentially a really big deal.
Wooten says soon 60 to 70% of the mussels on this island coastline could be gone. And that's bad for more than just mussels. They are central players in the marine food web, which includes the fish we eat.
So instead of a big solid band of mussels, you'll have little patches or mussels scattered around haphazardly. It'd be like changing a system from a heavy forest into a plain that's dotted with trees.
Wooten's research is published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The looming question is whether this rapid acidification is just a fluke occurrence on one island or whether the entire West Coast could soon feel these effects. Nobody knows because apparently nobody else along the coast has been monitoring the acidity of seawater this closely. But Jane Lubchenco at Oregon State University is worried.
Ocean acidification is likely one of the most serious and insidious changes underway, and it was one that was not even on our radar screen. And it looms large.
Lubchenco says biologists have focused mostly on the risk to corals and plankton that have calcium shells that can literally dissolve away if the ocean gets too acidic. But the latest study shows the problems are likely also much closer to home, and it's likely to get worse for a long time to come. Lubchenco says it won't be easy to curtail our emissions of carbon dioxide.
Even if we do, it's not going to fix the ocean acidification problem immediately. There's a long time lag in the system.
The oceans will keep soaking up the carbon dioxide that's already in the atmosphere. So, she says, at least we should take whatever other steps we can to reduce the stresses on marine life. Richard Harris, NPR News.
You can read more about the ocean's role in the carbon cycle by going to npr.org.
Terry Tempest-Williams writes about the collision of the human and natural worlds. The environmental writer is best known for her 1991 book, Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place, that weaves together the author's personal experiences with observations of nature and man's impact on it. Her new book also combines seemingly disparate elements, her apprenticeship in mosaic design, the challenges facing the Utah prairie dog, and genocide in Rwanda. It's called Finding Beauty in a Broken World. Caitlin Shetterly has the story.
Finding Beauty in a Broken World had its genesis on the one-year anniversary of September 11th.
We watched the towers collapse. We watched America choose war. The peace in our own hearts shattered. How to pick up the pieces. What to do with the pieces. I was desperate to retrieve the poetry I had lost. Standing on a rocky point in Maine, looking east toward the horizon at dusk, I faced the ocean. Give me one wild word. It was all I asked of the sea.
Williams writes that the sea answered mosaic. She took this message literally and signed up for a mosaic apprenticeship in Ravenna, Italy. She found out that she wasn't any good at making art out of broken bits of tile.
And because I couldn't create a mosaic out of tessera, I wanted to see could I create a mosaic out of words. And the question can be asked, why have an essay about prairie dogs next to an essay about the Rwandan genocide? I believe that there are semblances between seemingly disparate ideas if we can stand back and see a larger picture.
William's talent is making the larger picture personal, says her father, John Tempest. He points to her book Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place, and the way it links her mother's death from ovarian cancer to nuclear testing in Utah. John Tempest says it wasn't easy for him when the personal went public.
Refuge was hard for me. It was about the death of my wife, and it was hard for me, and we had a lot of go-arounds on it. But in the long run, I think it has helped a lot of people. I mean, even when Refuge was on tour, the book tour, all the women would come bringing their mother and their sister with their bandanas on their head because they were taking chemotherapy. And so all these, the audience would just be full of bald women taking chemotherapy, see? And it was so touching, and I think they were helped by the message of hope that nature is a cycle, you know, and things eventually cycle around and it all works out. That's the basic premise of Refuge, and basically it's the premise of this book probably too. And I think it is true. You know, it is healing. Nature is healing. It's all a great big cycle.
Connecting human life to nature's cycle puts Terry Tempest Williams in good company, says Jennifer Sahn, editor of Orion Magazine.
Refuge was an amazing book for what it did to bring the story of human health and the story of environmental health together in a really passionate way. No one had done that as passionately since Rachel Carson. And I think Terry was the most prominent woman nature writer since Carson.
Like the author of Silent Spring, Terry Tempest Williams is an environmentalist committed to showing man's impact on the land. Her connection to nature was forged as a young girl. Her father ran a family pipelaying business and took her out on jobs with him all over the American West.
I read one time, I was reading, and it said, a girl 14 just as physically strong and fit as a boy. So I treated Terry like a boy. I took her deer hunting with me everywhere. And so I taught her a lot of lessons. I took her out on the jobs with me. So she's taken it from there and gone way beyond I ever thought of, you know.
It was on these trips that Terry Tempest Williams learned to pay close attention to the natural world. That skill came in handy when she was researching the second section of her book, which is about prairie dogs.
I watched prairie dogs every day stand with their paws pressed together, facing the rising sun in total stillness for up to 30 minutes. And then I watched them at the end of the day take that same gesture. 30 minutes before the sun goes down, they would press their palms together in perfect stillness. I don't mean to anthropomorphize, but when you look at a creature that has survived over the millennium, begin and end each day in that kind of stance, it causes one to think about one's own life and the speed and rapidity with which we live.
The prairie dog family that she observed is one of the last remaining Utah prairie dog communities on protected land. In 1973, the Utah prairie dog was put on the endangered species list. But after lobbying from developers and ranchers, it was demoted to a threatened species. Most Westerners see them as pesky rodents, more suited to extermination than protection.
In my perspective, as a young boy, when we were on our way to Jackson Hole or in Wyoming, driving with my parents, let us out, and my brother and I, with our 22s, would shoot dozens of them just for target practice, you know. And they were everywhere, see what I mean? They were just so common, it was ridiculous. So I wouldn't tell Terry this, but I shot up to 100 of them in a day myself as a young boy, see.
In the last section of Finding Beauty in a Broken World, Terry Tempest Williams makes what some might consider a wild leap from the extermination of prairie dogs to the genocide in Rwanda. Montana novelist Rick Bass says this was a courageous choice.
People are going to criticize her for that, saying, oh, Terry, a prairie dog's not a human being. You can't write about the two things in the same book. She's not saying a prairie dog is a human being. She's saying we're killing everything from the bottom to the top with no culpability, no accountability, no emotions, no considerations. She's just bearing testimony to the things she loves about life and about being alive.
Terry Tempest Williams' decision to go to Rwanda followed a harrowing period in her life. Her brother had just died of lymphoma, a death she also believes is tied to nuclear testing. And she'd been studying the prairie dog's demise. Williams says she thought she couldn't handle any more death or pain.
You know, I look at the plight of the prairie dogs. I look at my brother's death from lymphoma as a downwinder. And I look at the causes that underlie any war. And I think if we look deeply enough, we see the same symptoms. It's about power. It's about greed. It's about certain elements of the population that are expendable.
For Terry Tempest Williams, it's this mosaic that needs to be pieced together so that we can learn from what we've done and repair what is broken. For NPR News, I'm Caitlin Shetterly.
On the Friday before Thanksgiving, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. We're about to talk about the biggest single barrier to a revolution in cars. We could be driving electric cars instead of gas. In fact, we might have been doing that for a century were it not for the batteries. Paul Eisenstein is with an independent auto news service called the Detroit Bureau.
To make the technology work, you need batteries that are smaller, lighter, significantly more powerful, delivering range that's more like a gasoline car.
Eisenstein says for electric cars to succeed now, they would need a battery that lasts for more than 100 miles before a recharge and has a charging time of 15 minutes, not 8 hours. Eisenstein has been looking at new cars available now at the LA Auto Show.
What we're seeing this week are hybrids, and what that does is it uses technology, electric technology, to recapture energy that's normally lost when you're braking or coasting. But you're not primarily riding on battery. You're primarily using your gas engine.
It's jumping back and forth between the gas engine, the electric engine, and there's a little bit of each being used at all times.
Exactly. Now, the next level, which we're hearing a lot of discussion about, is the plug-in hybrid, or as the industry prefers, the extended-range electric vehicle, the Chevrolet Volt, which certainly gets a lot of attention. These vehicles are designed to ride primarily on their battery power, but they have gasoline engines as backup. That way, you don't have to have too much battery on board, at least not of the current technology batteries. So you can do your daily commute, and you may, if you only drive it for commuting purposes, you may never fire up the gasoline engine.
Let's figure that out so that I understand what's going on and how that's different from the hybrids you just described that are on the road now.
Mm-hmm.
With this thing, it's been plugged in all night. I get up in the morning, I'm on my way to work, and for the first 30 or 40 or however many miles, that battery is driving me exclusively, and it's only when the battery is dead that I'm using any gas. Is that right?
Exactly.
Okay, so the batteries that exist now, are they good enough for that to be a successful vehicle that millions of people could plausibly drive?
The simple answer? We don't know. All these manufacturers that are pushing for plug-ins or like extended-range vehicles, particularly GM with the Chevy Volt, are betting that the latest generation of lithium-ion battery technology, pretty much the same stuff you have in your cell phone, that they're going to be able to scale that up so it can push a car
if it's like what's in my cell phone, we're doomed. It's never going to work.
But that's the big worry. Not only will it provide enough power, but will it last for 100,000 miles or so? And the technology has to go even further if we're going to achieve the real breakthrough, what everybody wants, which is the pure electric vehicle. Yeah, they've got batteries that are good enough and getting better for standard hybrids, like the Prius, like the Ford Escape hybrid, and the new Mercury Milan hybrid that they're showing at the LA show. But now they have to make the breakthrough for these plug-in vehicles, and those batteries are going to jump to lithium technology.
Is there any sense that you have that Detroit, by being so far behind, Toyota say, when it comes to hybrids, might end up ahead because their first generation of widely selling hybrids might have better batteries and a better system and be this plug-in system that might go beyond what the Prius say can do right now for Toyota?
Yeah, certainly the batteries that are going into the next generation of the Ford hybrids, the Mercury Milan and the Ford Fusion that they're going to be showing in L.A., those are significantly better, from what I understand, than the batteries in the Prius. But it's a war out there. These manufacturers are racing to try to come up with better battery technology. So we are likely to see massive, massive breakthroughs in battery technology over the next few years. That said, I have to remember that it was 100 years ago when Henry Ford and Thomas Alva Edison sat down, and Edison calmly predicted he'd have the 100-mile battery in time for Henry's wife to be able to drive her electric vehicle. Well, here we are. A century later, they're still struggling.
Paul Eisenstein, thanks very much.
Good to be with you.
He's with the Detroit Bureau, an independent auto news service.